All right, it's September 29th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm talking with Maxine Van de Wettering. And Ms. Van de Wettering, I was hoping you could just start with a little basic information about your background, especially your educational background, and what brought you to University of Montana in Missoula.
I have a BA in physics and another one in history from the University of California, that is UCLA in Berkeley. I have no master's, and I went on to get a PhD from the University of Washington in the history and philosophy of science. While I was at the University of Washington, I married my professor, who had his first permanent job offer at the University of Montana, and that's what brought me here.
Mm-hmm. What were your interests in pursuing history, philosophy of science?
Well, I had started out in physics, and in my senior year, I was captivated by a visiting professor at Berkeley who was visiting from the University of Washington. And he was a professor in the history and philosophy of science. His name was Harry Wolf. He went on to head up the Advanced Institute in Princeton. And I followed him, literally. I was a senior, and I switched my major so that I could be his student. And so I went to the University of Washington as soon as I got my degree and worked with him. His office mate was my husband.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how, and I was a teaching assistant for him, so that's how we met.
I relate to that in that I sort of tend to follow people in my educational career more than necessarily the discipline,
mm-hmm.
you know, and associate myself with people that I think are the best resources. So you made it to UM, you know, with your husband. Were you seeking a job here as well at the time?
No, I was still, I was writing my dissertation. I had just mm-hmm. finished all my qualifying exams when we came out, when we were married. And so I continued to do my dissertation between here and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just sort of, I had completed the requirements, so all I was doing was writing and sending chapters and stuff like that. Then my mentor, Harry, went on to Johns Hopkins, and from there to Princeton, and I couldn't go with him at that point because I wanted to stay with my husband.
Sure.
So it had to be long distance then.
Mm-hmm. So what were your hopes for putting that degree to work, or did you have hopes for doing that, being that you were here with your husband?
In those days, and I'm sure that's true today, professors and their first jobs were considered temporary kinds of positions. When John was appointed here, I believe it was 1961, and the market was fairly dry in that year. I think he had a couple of other offers, but we'd heard good things about the university, about the University of Montana, so we came here. But the expectation, really, like all young professors, was that this was not necessarily our permanent position.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was only the one university, and we had in mind that I would work too, it did seem like it would be temporary.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out not to be, for me anyway.
Right. How did that come about?
How did what come about?
Not being temporary and you being employed by the university.
It actually started, if I'm going to be really legitimate, it started because I'm Jewish. There was a small Jewish community in Missoula, and therefore tight. They were all centered around academia or the law.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they didn't have enough for a minion. I don't know if you know what a minion is.
I vaguely know what
10
one is.
Males.
I have.
For various ceremonies, you have to have 10 males.
Right.
And they needed a 10th one time. I think there were 10 male Jews here, but he wasn't available for some sort of a funeral or something. And the great consideration at that time is, would John count? Because we're a mixed marriage, but after all, it's a matrilineal family.
Right.
And I carry the big macha stuff, so maybe he would count. And I think they let him in. But the closeness of the Jewish community meant that I got in touch with people in the university right away. A geologist named Arnold Silverman, who was one of the Jewish members of the community, was very interested himself in the history of science. We had long talks, and he thought it would be great to have it. It was an exotic field then, very young. He thought, at least here, he thought it would be great to have a history of science program, and he had been doing a little teaching in the history of geology, which is natural for historical studies. And he had taught, I think, a couple of classes, but he hadn't been trained in it. So he was eager to talk to me about stuff like that. And it was his idea that I be hired even without my PhD. That was done in those days. If you had finished everything but your dissertation, you could get a job. The geology department hired me. I don't know how it came about. I don't know what the inside politics were. I don't know how Arnold twisted arms, but they hired me, I think, almost as a lark. And I started to teach under the auspices of the geology department. I don't believe I taught there for a complete semester or quarter. I can't remember what it was. I think it was quarters then. I don't think I taught there for... I taught a couple of quarters, maybe, but I don't think I stayed with the geology department for very long because the idea to the history department chairman of that time of an historian of science teaching in a geology department, when the history department didn't have a historian of science, was appalling. And so the history department chair, a fellow named Mel Wren at the time, who was totally autocratic, the politics were more fascinating than the studies, hired me away, thereby breaking a nepotism rule. And I taught in the history department, I think, for maybe a year. After that, maybe a year and a half. The documents are there somewhere. Or maybe I taught there longer, because once John became chairman of the history department, then it was not just nepotism. Then there was a real conflict of interest, and it got too indelicate. And at that point, I was interested in any case in going to another department, because it's less healthy, especially when the departments were so politicized as they were in those days, and they may still be. The politics of the departments, I think, are just as interesting as some of the other things that go on in the world. Pause.
So talk a little bit about the politics of the department. I mean, you know, it's easy to just say the politics of the department, and I assume that means there were conflicts and different interests, but expand on that a little bit.
I don't think that I do mean conflicts and different interests. I think I mean a tone. That I think that we don't appreciate enough how important administrative tone is. The department chair was not only an autocrat, he was not a beneficent autocrat. He liked power, he liked using it, he was a kind of a threatening presence, so that what you had was an awful lot of fawning in the department. Not because the members were themselves fawning types, but the atmosphere was such that if you wanted to simply get along with it, you had to play the game. There were those who played more obsequiously than the others. So I don't know that that would be conflict, but it was a disquieting kind of atmosphere, and the department chair was very, very powerful. What's more, there were a handful of chairs at that time who were very close to the president of the university, who also set that kind of tone. So if there was conflict, it was not a healthy kind of conflict where there was difference of opinion. It was whether or not you were good enough at being obsequious or not. And that was the general tenor of the department, so that people like Jules Carlin, who was extremely independent and outspoken, or another person like Mort Borden, who was doing some interesting things and tried to stay aloof from it, were not in, whereas you must take names out, right? Whereas other people became sort of the inside clique. That was my impression of the history department. But being part of the Jewish community, which was small here, meant that we had access to other departments as well, mostly the English department, which was really interesting. Now, there were conflicts over interpretation, conflicts over whether the creative writing area of the department was more prestigious than the critical writers, and the kinds of conflicts they had were really about the nature of critical writing, who were the most prominent authors at the time, who should we be reading. And I remember at that time, because we were so involved with the English department, our conversations with English department members were always very exciting. And this was in the day when Philip Roth was the rising star, and Leslie Fiedler, who pretty much ran the department, was just the most fascinating intellect, was touting Philip Roth. So we were talking about Philip Roth, and we were talking about Saul Bellow, and all of that kind of stuff in the English department, whereas in the history department, we were talking about whether or not we should give the chairman's daughter a B, or whether we'd better go ahead with an A, because she was in the various classes. Now, that really can't be for publication, but that's what I mean by tone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there was a kind of a nascent humanities program, really started by Leslie Fiedler, because he was so interested in interdepartmental kinds of courses. And literature was a natural basis for that kind of thing. And he had actually started a humanities program that was very productive, very interesting. And so when I was hired in that, when I was offered a job in that department, I just grabbed it.
In the English department?
Humanities.
Humanities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would have no, I know nothing about English.
So tell
or
me
geology.
About this humanities department. I'm not familiar with this creation of a humanities
department. It wasn't a department, it was a program.
Okay.
And what they did was offer kinds of, it's not great books, but it was great concepts as revealed through classical or profound works of literature.
Mm-hmm.
So what they would do was they would have a quarter of sort of ancient literature and philosophy, and then medieval. It went in a chronological way, and they would pick out fine works of literature and examine them in terms of larger concepts of the meaning of life, or the way in which politics are done, or maybe sociological principles. But it was just a very, very interesting kind of inquiry. The staff of it were people who were begged to come in, giving up their own time, or the department would donate some time so that people could teach in these classrooms. And that's the story of just about everything innovative that went on at the school. That was the story of women's studies, too, is we would try to raid departments for some of their members, get them release time, often not. Often they would volunteer their time to teach some classes. Then what would happen? The classes would be wildly popular. We were counting student heads, so that departments would then try to pull back these faculty members and sort of accommodate these classes to their own curriculum. It was always a fight to keep the curriculum independent of the department while taking the department members.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So departmental politics then was a different kind of political game at that point, but it was bargaining.
So how did it happen for you personally? Did you move into this humanities program and were employed by it, or were you still in the history department and
I went
shifting
from,
your time?
I gave some time from the history department to the humanities department. At some point or another, the program tried to become departmental. It was called the liberal arts department, got a sort of a quasi-chairman, and began to be run out of the philosophy department largely.
Mm-hmm.
And just about that time, philosophy was always the department that was most closely integrated with the larger humanities program. The philosophy department asked me to join them, because after all, my degree was in the history and philosophy of science, and my minor all through college had been in philosophy. So it was a natural fit, and I went there, I think, sometime in 1970, 71,
mm-hmm.
and was there ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a totally different department, too, with different kinds of politics and
Give me some examples of the differences. I mean, you have a pretty good position to make some comparisons from. You've been in
a lot.
Berkeley, and then University of Washington, and then University of Montana,
and
three departments here.
During the time when Mel Wren was chair of the history department, There, I believe that was Henry Bugbee, who was chairing the philosophy department at the time. These were big names. These were big powers on the campus who had the president's ear and had different kinds of modes of operation themselves. Where the history department was totally autocratic, the philosophy department was democratic to a fault. Everything was consensus. We would meet forever. We never stopped meeting. And it was a convivial department, but consensus is not an easy way to live, especially since every professor I have ever met has always thought of himself as a better administrator than anybody else around. So everybody's ego has to be managed and massaged and accommodated, and to get a consensus means that you really have to ultimately get along. And the philosophy department did. They were quite a different kind of ball of wax. They spent a lot of time talking about students, talking about the nature of philosophy, talking about what ought to be taught and how to accommodate Montana kinds of students. The history department talked, when they talked intellectual stuff, talked about who was publishing, what kind of publications could get well-grounded in good journals. It was rarely about student interests. It was about private advancement and what was happening in the world of history. In the philosophy department, we talked almost not at all what was happening in the world of academic philosophy, but a great deal about what was happening to philosophy students. And I think it has maintained that tone. Very careful with students. Students were pretty central. We would talk about the students we shared. And that's why we were able to get so many Rhodes Scholars coming out of the philosophy department. We really nurtured them.
So I want to ask you a few things that you mentioned in there. I guess, first of all, you know, I mentioned your position to make comparisons. What was unique or different, special or not special, about the University of Montana, having come from UCLA, Berkeley, University of Washington? And in particular, you know, putting University of Montana in the same sentence as those schools, which were clearly much bigger then and still are bigger to a degree, the rigor of the University of Montana, its progressiveness or lack thereof.
You know, it's hard to deal with the university as a single entity because departments and schools are so independent, not only in their ambitions, but in their values. If I were going to have to generalize in a very large way, and this changed over the years, I think that the University of Montana was consciously Western and wanted to be, whereas UCLA, Berkeley, the other large schools that I've dealt with, felt themselves to be much more a part of an Ivy League-oriented kind of world community. I don't know that Montana didn't do that in defiance, because they couldn't. I think not. I think that the professors I met here, for the great majority of the ones who I worked with when I came, were from Ivy League schools, were from the best, and somehow had brought their urbanity and their training in some sort of a congruence with the experience of being in the West. And it is a different kind of experience. And it's not exactly a lack of sophistication. It's almost a simplifying of sophisticated concepts into a more colloquial language. The concept is still as deep as it was. A lot of the pretensions are gone, and I don't think that it lost much of the subtlety. So it was a very positive kind of experience intellectually, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you put it in pretty eloquent terms, I think, what consciously Western means. And I wonder how that was done in a department like philosophy.
In philosophy, it was easy. In philosophy, there was always talk about the land and the nature of how the land spoke to the meaning of being in the world. Henry Bugbee was a master at that. I mean, one could never understand the sentences that came out of his mouth, even though you understood every single word in the sentence. The way in which he strung it together was so, his word would be evocative, that you had to just listen to the sound of it rather than the meaning of the words, and in that way you were listening to a stream. Mm-hmm. And then trying to deal with that one, if you like. And then try to interpret what it is to you. It was a way of dealing with thought such that the person who was listening to the thought was always called into question himself in the manner in which he listened, if you know what I'm talking about. I find that very Western, very much oriented to bringing the sensations alive rather than the intellectual process.
It's so interesting to hear that that was coming out of the philosophy department. Oh, it's what I associate with the creative writing department and the English department here
that
now.
That too? There was a lot of connection between the philosophy department and the creative writing department because their themes were alike. Mm-hmm. The themes were the land, how you live in the land, the history of science, and the philosophy of science moves very deeply into that. Henry himself was always an ecologist, the fisherman who throws back the fish, but who can talk endlessly about the arc of the cast, and how it swishes through the water, and how the water talks back to the arc. Things I never understood, but it was a different way of looking at the world that was very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. And it works for other areas as well. Once you get a handle on it and you try to apply it to other places, it's very illuminating. Mm-hmm. So it was fun for me. Then there was Leslie Fiedler. Magnificent.
His name has come up many times with many people.
He was amazing.
Most recently spoke with Meyer Chesson. And he's in a very different department, but found himself in the company of Leslie Fiedler and the English department more often than not.
Because of the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was in the center, not only the English department, but of the Jewish community. And the kind of center he was is that it wasn't as though we got together and honored the Sabbath, but we questioned the Sabbath, questioned what it meant to be a Jew, questioned what it meant to be a half-Jew. It was a tempestuous and interesting time. We lost a great deal when we lost him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he started up the humanities program as well, so left an incredible imprint on this campus.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went to the University of Buffalo, at the SUNY Buffalo campus, did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible guy.
So you also mentioned, and I suspect this is tied in with the emphasis on being consciously Western, you said that the department was very conscious of how to integrate Montana students.
Mm-hmm.
What are these Montana students? I mean, what was that all about?
If you grow up in an Eastern city, you grow up with a certain kind of wisdom, we usually call it streetwise, where you expect that there are menaces in the world, that people are out to get you, that there's such a thing as a sharpshooter, that there are carpetbaggers around, that the world, it's not exactly an unfriendly place, but that the world is filled with snags, and you've got to be able to manipulate around them, and city kids learn that pretty early, and it's not a big deal. You just learn how to do it. You're less trustful, slightly more cynical, a little more critical of the way in which people present themselves. You expect that there are masks around. I found that the students in Montana were ingenuous, took things at face value a great deal, that it was more difficult to move them into critical analysis, that straightforward empirical evidence, induction, was very strong for them. they were observant. They would pick up things. But then to suspect that this might not be the way it appeared, or to expect that things had layers, that you had to uncover them, that was a little more difficult, and I wasn't accustomed. I was accustomed to having students who expected mm-hmm. that there was going to be something that was fooling you around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't find a great sense of irony or satire. It was almost as though we had to work through that together, and that was very refreshing for me,
mm-hmm.
and also very interesting, a different kind of intellect. The categories hadn't been drawn. It was not unusual for a student to call me Max, maybe the third or fourth time that they'd met me.
Hmm.
And it wasn't that they were being disrespectful. It was that's the way they took the world, as it came, without the expectation that there would be layers of appropriateness or layers of decor that they had to subscribe to. Everything was upfront and direct. And I think that comes with being outside a great deal, having the world just come at you, not in hidden shadows.
You know, I don't know why this made me think of it, but you're mentioning that sense of the ingenuousness of students, the sense of trust. It made me think about, you know, you're here at a time where you're moving into, through, and out of the Vietnam War. And that would seem to me to be a time that would undermine people's trust in the world at large. Is that a fair assessment? Mm-hmm. Did that have any sort mm-hmm. of effect on
very
students?
Very big effect. And at universities, no matter where you are, the outside political world always deeply affects universities and the way in which things are taught and the way in which students behave. So does the administration. I'd love for somebody to do a work on the importance of the administrative tonality on the nature of a campus.
Mm-hmm.
A president and a chair makes an enormous difference to the ambience. During the Vietnam period, the students here were very questioning, very inquisitive, and the kinds of protests, and there were protests, were very direct and upfront. There were no plannings about how we can get to the president's residence or how we could undermine this kind of thing. It was direct protest, as I would expect of Montana students. And the student body president at the time was also very much involved with this. And the Kaiman was very much involved. An interesting direct confrontational kind of approach, different from the kind of thing you'd find at Berkeley, where there would be massive, almost sinister kinds of organizations working on a great many levels of undergroundness and above-groundness, and there'd be a lot of strategic planning. This was, I am unhappy with this situation, and I think we'd better let you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The students were much better than the faculty in that way.
Hmm. What, if any, effect did it have?
I don't think that it made the students more cynical, if that's what you're after. I don't think that it made them what I would call more Eastern. I think that you almost have to have a steady experience of what the world is like
mm-hmm.
to be this kind of street smart. It exhilarated them. It was the beginning of new courses. It gave us a Black Studies program temporarily that was, in my opinion, a disaster. It made possible a women's studies program, or at least we were able to put it on the table in a way that advanced us more rapidly than we would have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But though it was there before, too.
So you were pretty involved in the putting that on the table in the women's studies department.
Not as central as you're implying. I was I was not one of the great movers, and
mm-hmm.
I was certainly not the originator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the sorts of things that I and some of my colleagues were doing, we were all self-taught at that time. None of us had been prepared for anything like this. And most of us, at the very beginning, were very skeptical about the worthiness of such a program. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem to make a lot of sense until we got into the literature ourselves and did a lot of deep thinking. It was not a political evolution. It was an intellectual one. It was the thought of it came from politics, I believe, but I'm not certain. The development of it was wholly intellectual. It was because there was a missing, big chunk of missing consciousness in our entire academic training. That mm-hmm. there were questions that could be answered if you looked at it as though women were writing the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that in medieval history, saw it in American history, certainly saw it in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the women's movement is responsible for a great deal of our modern character,
mm-hmm.
including the emphasis we have on sense and feeling, and some of it not so happy.
Well, you certainly see that in the English department now. I mean, some of the top-notch professors down there in the English department are women, and they mm-hmm. write about women, mm-hmm. and they're very mm-hmm. conscious mm-hmm. of that women's mm-hmm. voice mm-hmm. as a unique voice.
Mm-hmm.
So who were the people that were sort of the originators of women's study? And I also want to ask, if you can tie it into that, is were these new departments like women's studies, black studies, even Native American studies mm-hmm. at the time, were those born simultaneously as a project altogether, or did they come about pretty independently?
The notion of them was simultaneous.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly came out of the 60s. Truthfully, it came out of the 50s. It predated the Vietnam War. It came out of the McCarthy period, the aftermath of the McCarthy period. There was a great deal of rethinking. I think that we haven't assess the importance of the McCarthy period deeply enough. I think that we see the 60s as an entity unto itself. It really sprang from the McCarthy era.
Hmm.
There was a fear, I think, that came directly from the McCarthy period about speaking out. People really lost their jobs. People went to jail. University campuses, faculty members were shut up or fired. Now, we lived through that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a student in the history of science, I was scheduled to receive an NSF fellowship. And it was a full ride. And I turned it down because they demanded a loyalty oath. And it might be nice to say that I just didn't believe in loyalty oaths, but the truth was, if I had signed a loyalty oath, I could have gone to jail because I had some connections with leftist organizations or what had been called leftist organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many other people did that sort of thing. Professors at the University of Washington were fired. Professor Mort Borden here was threatened in the halls of the Montana legislature with his job because he had said something about how socialism was part of the heritage of northern Montana. In the halls of the legislature, some poop stood up and said, "That guy's got to be fired."
Hmm.
That was the kind of world we had come out of. And the 60s, where we were much more comfortable speaking out, then gave vent to the oppression that we had felt before. I mean, I don't believe that that connection has been made clearly enough, but that's what I happen to believe. And that's where the Women's Studies program was born. I think it came out of all those little responses to the end of McCarthyism, where the women in the little leftist groups were told to make the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And they who had just found their voice now and their courage were taken aback by being told to make the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the beginning of women's studies. That mm-hmm. would be the 50s.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sort of at a loss, really, to name many women that I've heard mentioned as professors on this campus during the time when you came.
Well, I think that, no, there were almost none. There were just a handful of women professors. And the and where I was, I think, important to the Women's Studies program is that I was immediately willing to teach in the program mm-hmm. for academic credit because I had been reading mm-hmm. because of Betty Friedan, really. But that's the 50s. And so I was prepared to teach, but it was really Judy Smith and Diane Sands who started that thing. Mm-hmm. Both extremely qualified women, but who were not academic, or they were not a, they might very well be academicians, but they had no position. And they started the Women's Resource Center, which was an adjunct, a kind of place for women to gather on the campus for mm-hmm. students and maybe faculty, but there was no faculty, to gather and talk about what it meant to be a woman. And that was the real beginning institutionally of the Women's Studies program. We taught courses, but institutionally you have to give credit to Diane Sands and Judy Smith. These are the two who were involved. The few women faculty then who picked up Lois Welch.
And she was in
English
at that time.
And there wasn't anybody. The women on the faculty who were here were not necessarily in favor of a women's studies program. Mm-hmm. Apart from Lois, I don't think there was anybody. Mm-hmm. I may be forgetting.
Were there people adamantly opposed to it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you know I'm going to want to hear that story.
Well, I had long... Linda Fry and I debated in the Faculty Senate endlessly about that, and some of the debates were not very pleasant mm-hmm. because she thought it was just a mockery. Of course, she then went and published all sorts of stuff about women's studies as a bibliography. Her essays are bibliographical. But she certainly was opposed to any women's studies program.
So was she opposed to having it as its separate program instead of just being integrated?
She didn't think that there was such a study, period, that it would enhance history or anything, mm-hmm. and that women's experiences were included, that there wasn't a gender aspect to the way in which studies or inquiries had been made, and that to isolate women was simply to falsify a kind of record. Now, I'm saying it in a way that I think she would say it. Mm-hmm. She certainly...
That's interesting.
Is it?
So what did you start out teaching in women's studies? I mean, what did
a course called Women in America. And okay. what I did was... take the images that were presented of women in popular literature chronologically from the colonial period, it was a year-long course, to, I think I, through Portnoy's Complaint, took popular literature, asked my students to take a look at it in as detached a way as possible and talk about how the culture seemed to regard women as they were depicted in popular literature. So we had a couple of images that came forth, the pretty standard ones, the bitch, mm-hmm. the mother, I mean, the giving mother, not the Philip Wiley mother, mm-hmm. not the Generation of Vipers mother, but the kind of know-all mother and little frightening mother, Philip Roth's mother. That's not too frightening, it's kind of just incredible power. The colonial woman, the early American woman who was a real voice for religion, I had them read Anne Bradstreet and read sermons. Hmm. And then there were the Victorian women who were an extremely interesting bunch. Domestic literature. It was a good course.
How did students take it?
They loved it. Mm-hmm. It was, well, first of all, it's fun. Because they're reading popular literature. And second of all, the women finally had a way of connecting to history that they had not had before because they recognized the issues. It's as though you're in a foreign language half the time when you're in school as a woman, and then suddenly it's in English. The issues were intimate. They were not far removed from their experiences so that they didn't have to imagine themselves as a hero or as a king, which took a flight of imagination, and so you live in a never-never land. And all of a sudden, they were right in the middle of the historical experience. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them would say, so that's why I feel that way. It's, I don't know how it is for men, but when you, I have a son, and I sort of saw it in my own experience as a mother, but when you read history as a boy, I think that you can visualize yourself in some of the positions of the heroes. And I'm not talking Napoleon or Washington, but I'm certainly talking Franklin. Mm-hmm. You can play at that in a real way. For a girl, it becomes a fairy tale. And so you imagine yourself, you imagine the story without yourself in it. For the first time, they were getting history as a story in which they could they could see themselves in it, and the kind of invitation in it to become somebody like that. Mm-hmm. So that their ambitions get a little bit awakened by it. And those experiences were interesting to me as a teacher.
Wow, I'd never thought about it like that.
You should have taken the course.
Right. Well, did many men take the course?
No.
Yeah.
They were very uncomfortable in the mm-hmm. course. And what would happen frequently in the course was that some revelations made, a lot of the revelations made the women very, very angry. And angry at their boyfriends, and angry at men in general. It's simply something that's got to be gotten through. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to suddenly be liberated without exclaiming over why you hadn't done it 5 years ago and not blaming somebody. Mm-hmm. So the courses were not just an academic experience for me, they were also kind of a counseling experience for me, which was tough. Because I wasn't trained, not only in the subject, but in how to deal with students' anger.
Right.
And then the women of the students, of course, because there were so few women professors, would tend to come to a woman for counseling anyway, for just advice about their lives. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of women who were angry.
Were there other women that were teaching courses at the time that you were sharing this experience with?
Well, in my
case... Did you have someone to share your experience with, I guess?
No, I had a wonderful husband. Wonderful son. The other woman in my department, Cynthia Schuster, was extremely unsympathetic to women's studies, and her position was that if you wanted to teach, or if you wanted to be a female student, there were certain things you would give up, and one of them was a family life. Mm-hmm. Because that was the sacrifice that you made for a career, and she did it, and it was, and this was not an uncommon feature. Mm-hmm. Why should you get it so easy? And that's almost the way it was couched. It's a strange kind of almost parabolic. It makes you want to read the parables of Jesus again. Because why should you have it good when I haven't had it good? What do you mean you're giving him the big party, Dad?
Huh. How about the administration? Did you have support from administrators?
I was here a long time. We couldn't have done it without the support mm-hmm. of administrators. We shouldn't make any qualms about that. No mm-hmm. matter how the faculty love to damn the administration, you can't do it without the administration. So that it was done means automatically that there was administrative support. It got much, much better as we got popular, mm-hmm. which figures. But I can't say that the administration was our problem to begin with. The faculty were more the problem. It's very difficult to change curriculum or to, you know, when you do women's studies, you're changing your sources too, just like when you do the history of science or when you work with Dan Flores. You're not looking at the old documents anymore because there aren't any women's experiences there. So what are you going to do? You're going to go look at school records and church records and autobiographies and novels written by women or birth and death records to see how long they live. This required a whole new resource that seemed frivolous.
Before.
So that was not an easy... I remember I was the one who presented to the Faculty Senate to get it accepted in the curriculum. I had to promise that it wouldn't cost a cent, that no department would be put out at all, that we would teach it out of our hides, that it was traditional. This is where I fought with Linda Fry, meeting after meeting, session after session. When it finally got through, I felt more triumphant than I have ever felt in my life, except when I gave birth, mm-hmm. which was the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were birthing a new study.
Didn't know it at the time. Just wanted to teach a course and have the students get credit for it. It was a good course. It was mm-hmm. academically sound.
How did it change throughout your time here? And I guess, did you stay involved in
mm-hmm.
it? I should ask that first.
To the end, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did it change?
I added courses.
Mm-hmm.
Did some... The images course pretty much stayed because that's a natural. That's an easy kind of course. Taught a course on an introduction to philosophy in which we dealt with an introduction to philosophers in terms of the ways in which they dealt with women. And that I thought was a very interesting course too. Not because of me, but because the stuff is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able to look at Aristotle's view of women biologically
mm-hmm.
and the way in which he, and the influence of this all through the years. And we looked at Plato, and we looked at some of the other Kant. So it was that a nice introduction for women to see that they were also part of the philosophical enterprise, not a flattering one, but an interesting one. And ethics of the family, of course, involved women. And then there were just ways of looking at history and philosophy as though women were the subjects and the way in which you would play around with that. So I did some seminars on that. And taught those courses mm-hmm. throughout the time. And then a lot of other women came on board as younger faculty came in.
So, you know, Kant, Aristotle, Plato, I mean, this is not fluffy, pink-collar academic stuff here, you know?
It was never that. It was not that.
Were you... You know, once other faculty members began seeing the rigor of it, were you accepted more? Was the program accepted more?
I was accepted, mm-hmm. and my courses were accepted. Unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate, there were other courses that appeared to be touchy-feely kinds of things, and I think they were. I'm not sure that's bad. It wasn't my kind of thing. I didn't find a lot of value in it. But I'm not sure that it wasn't good for the students.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that isn't a remedial kind of course that we need to give them if they don't get it elsewhere. So that's a different kind of philosophy. It wasn't my cup of tea, and I couldn't have done it. I just was totally ill-equipped to let people talk about their experiences in an unsystematic way. And that's the way it appeared to me. But I'm not sure that that's a bad way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a number of courses that didn't have the kind of respect academically. But I'm not sure that that was a virtuous or a smart thing to be doing.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier...
My courses were traditional.
Yeah.
And I think that some of the other women disdained me for that. I'm not sure. I didn't ever heard it personally. I just kind of felt that they would like me to have done more of the other stuff.
Were there models for you? Were you able to look at other university programs or anywhere to, you know,
No.
of that?
Well, I had some wonderful colleagues. Carol Smith Rosenberg was an enormous help, but we were all doing it about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So she came up after the program had been launched with some wonderful syllabi, which is extremely useful right now. But that it just wasn't, I couldn't draw on that at
mm-hmm.
that point.
And so were other places drawing on your program here?
I don't think so. I think we were all simultaneously groping ourselves and doing different kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
We got together every now and again at meetings, but mm-hmm. it was not... We didn't have the mechanism or the organization or the administrative support or money to do the sorts of things that you do at normal meetings where, mm-hmm. where professors get together and discuss their work. Mm-hmm. We had crazy kinds of organizations that I wouldn't. Oh, dear, some of our... The National Women's Studies Association in the early days was just a riot. Anything went.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not my model. So,
mm-hmm.
But now it's everywhere. We have our niche.
So something else you mentioned earlier that I've definitely heard a bit about was your success in Rhodes Scholars,
mm-hmm.
promoting or getting Rhodes mm-hmm. Scholars mm-hmm. from the University of Montana. Talk a little bit about that.
Again, the credit is not really mine. You have to go to Tom Huff for that one. I got into the Rhodes because when I was quite a young professor, I had a chemistry student named Mark Pepler, the History of Science. Mm-hmm. A lot of my students came out of the History of Science program because it's rigorous and it's interdisciplinary. So the kids who could make it in the Rhodes,
mm-hmm.
and it was not required. So it was self-selective. So I really had good students. I was very fortunate in that. This guy was really, really bright. And at that time, was he working? Could it be Eugene McCarthy? I don't remember. But he was involved in politics. He was an interesting kind of guy. And at the same time that he was my student, I had been involved in some kind of a talk for the Montana Committee for the Humanities. And there was somebody present there who sat on a Rhodes State Committee. And because of the talk, asked me, I'm obviously not a Rhodes Scholar, to sit on the Montana Committee. And when I sat on the state committee, and I think I was on it for about 7 years, I learned what a Rhodes Scholar was, and this guy fit the bill. So I wrote a recommendation. I had not yet begun to serve on the Rhodes Scholarship Committee, but I had been invited when I had this student. So I invited him. I said, you must apply for the Rhodes. It sounds like you're just the kind of guy. And my first meeting with the state committee, they didn't want to take him on. They didn't want to recommend him because he did not have the grade point average. They wanted, in those days, a grade point average of something like 3.8. It was very stiff. They wanted you to have A's and B's and be able to be a football star and all of that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And I saw in him a real inventiveness of mind and a kind of rigor that I thought was perfect for the Rhodes, and also an ethical commitment. So I pushed for him. And because I think they were trying to please me as the freshman member, they decided to send him as an also-ran. You know, that they just to show me that, or to give me the credibility I wanted and to sort of show me that I had a lot to learn. And he got a Rhodes. So when he got the Rhodes, then I became, all of a sudden, overnight, the great Mach. Like I knew what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing. But because he made it, I got the credit. Not him, poor kid. He didn't get anything. He just... So after that, then when I recommended people, they gave me a lot of rope. And then I started to really get interested in discover that what you had to do was get your students early, that what you were looking for was some kind of an ethical standing, a student who cared about the way of the world and not just himself. And so I learned to ask the right kinds of questions like you do, and in that way be able to discern the sort of student who would fit the Rhodes, and then I would send him the best professors on campus. And that was the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
There are an awful lot of, let me correct, there are a good handful of really good professors on the campus who would nurture students and not just coddle them, but nurture them intellectually, who gave them extremely challenging courses and I think changed the direction of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
How did you get to students early?
I read their essays.
Mm-hmm.
When you teach in the humanities course, you get the freshman kids, you can spot the little spark. And if you take the trouble, and if they're willing, you can nurture a student along. We're teaching in the history of science, and you read a really interesting essay, something with a twist, something that's not a regurgitation. But the courses that I taught invited the best writing and the best thinking. And you get hold of the students and you simply talk to them and see if they're interested in something like that. And a chance to go to Oxford is a nice experience for a Montana student. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we were successful. And Tom and I worked together on all of them. And you should talk to him about the roads.
Okay.
He was a state secretary for a long time. I could spot them, but he nurtured them.
Mm-hmm. So I know that, and I suspect this is when you were sort of at your, before you retired here, that you, I believe, wrote, well, this probably would have been earlier, that part of starting Women's Study was mm-hmm. you writing a memo yeah. or a letter to President Dennison about the starting of that.
Was it Dennison? I thought it was earlier than that. Had to be.
Well, you tell me. I've just heard the story that, you know, you had to write up this memo. And
it wasn't a memo. It was an essay. Mm-hmm. And I think it was published in something called the Montana Liberal Arts Journal. It wasn't Dennison. We had a very good dean for a very short period of time. I should remember who the president was. Was it Bucklew? Was it Cook? Was it Bowers? This is a graveyard for presidents, you know. Dennison is.
I've certainly heard it called that before.
Well, we had some really crappy presidents. There's just no two ways about mm-hmm. it. We had some. I think it might have been Bowers, but I'm not sure. The dean was just wonderful. He was only here a few years. And he started, it was called the CAS Journal, the College of Arts and Science Journal. And I think it only had 4 issues. Pretty sure that's where I wrote it. Yeah, I'm positive. One of them was the justification for a women's studies program, I believe. And so it's published somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it was, that's exactly what it was. It was an explanation of why academically this was a sound program mm-hmm. and was needed. And that was after my statement of the faculty senate, so it had already passed at that time. I don't think I had to convince anybody anymore. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, or somebody made me clarify it for the faculty at large, and mm-hmm. so I sat down and wrote the essay.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was the document that started it. Or if you're looking for a document, that's it.
Okay.
Nobody else was doing it at that point.
So, you know, it seems like, and now still, one of the 3 main jobs, I suppose, of an academic is service. And it certainly seemed like
I scrubbed
that was
floors.
So then, you know, everybody that I've talked to from the 60s particularly almost has more to say about things they were doing in the community, activism, you know, gathering with groups to discuss things than they do about what they were doing on campus. Has service remained a part of
my life?
Academia? And
in order to get a promotion or a raise mm-hmm. or even a good evaluation, there's the 3-legged stool.
Right.
You have to publish, you have to get good classroom evaluations, and you have to do community service. Usually, if you want a merit raise, 2 out of 3, you have to be extraordinary or above average. But this campus, everybody's above average. We have no poor professors. But in any case, it's the least important, I think, in terms of measurement for your promotion or for your raises. So I did community service. Is that the question?
Well, I'm interested in, you know, you mentioned also that you were looking for students who cared beyond just themselves. They cared about
yes.
the world and larger. And so I'm trying to get at sort of what your cares were beyond just the campus, in the community and the world at large.
The campus is the community mm-hmm. and the world at large. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people that are on the campus. outside the campus, I have been involved in politics up to a certain point. And of course, I spoke around at various groups, but to tell you the truth, it was in my field. The field is so large once you do women's studies and the history of science, and I think it's not fair to say that I did a lot of things in the community. I didn't, for example, give blood to the Red Cross, or what else? I didn't run for office. I was pretty much centered in my academic life, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. It somehow filled the day.
No doubt it did. Who would you name as some of the people that were, you know, inspirational or motivational to you in your career?
Here?
Here or beyond.
Leslie Fiedler, Henry mm-hmm. Bugbee, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Tom Huff, I think. Agatha Christie. Bach. That's a pretty, and Aristotle, of course, but that's a pretty good handful. I think poverty's a great motivator. I came from poor people.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was interviewing someone, and they were talking about how poverty and seeing poverty in the urban South in the 50s and 60s was a huge motivator for them. And then I sort of foolishly said, well, then you came here to Missoula, and so how did you translate that motivation here? Or where did you find the outlet for that motivation here? And they just said, there's poverty all over Montana. Not the same as you see in urban areas.
And I'll tell you something else that poverty does. I'm not talking about seeing poverty. I'm talking about living in poverty. Mm-hmm. It makes you afraid. Mm-hmm. It scares the shit out of you. Mm-hmm. And you want to have a good job. Mm-hmm. And you understand how important it is for a student not to just... We can't be ivory towerish with our students. Our students need to work, and we have to be able to acclimate ourselves to help our students work. It's no fun being poor. And sometimes we dismiss that too easily. Mm-hmm. And so coming out of poverty, I think that one of the great motivators in my life was not to be poor. Mm-hmm. And this was a nice job.
Yeah. You know, that really obvious logic is, I think, lost on people who don't have the shadow of the Depression in
their
lifetime.
I think so, but it doesn't have to be the Depression, because I it was a little bit before my time.
Right.
But you can see, I grew up in a ghetto, mm-hmm. and it wasn't the Depression, and people were very, very poor mm-hmm. and mean. Poor people get very mean. I don't want to be like that. Mm-hmm. It's not just that you want money, it's that you don't want to live like a dog. Mm-hmm. We got the dog in all of us, I think.
So I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit on something. And, you know, we still have a Native American studies program. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's mm-hmm. probably as strong now as it mm-hmm. ever has been. Mm-hmm. Women's studies, you could mm-hmm. say possibly mm-hmm. the same mm-hmm. thing, or mm-hmm. they're very active. But we also now have, Indian Education for All is quite a big topic in K-12. And, mm-hmm. you know, to hear people who are involved in higher education, it's having its effect in higher education as well. It's making people realize, well, we need to integrate more Indian education into our mm-hmm. curriculum. Mm-hmm. Are we close to being at a point, or will there be a point, where women's studies as a separate department will be superfluous, and women's voices, what you're teaching in women's studies, will be integrated into all the other humanities, if not sciences as well?
Sure. I think that there's no question, but it's not just women's studies. Mm-hmm. Geography. There used to be something called social studies. You could say history, to a large degree, is a disappearing category in high schools. I think that's an awful pity, because I think that the memory and the past is a category that ought to be permanent. Should women's studies? Probably not. Should Native American studies? These are too parochial. There are some basic elements of learning that we have to have. One of them is the honoring of memory. Mm-hmm. The other is the honoring of thought. So I would say that always we must have philosophy. We must always have history. But categories like chemistry, tell me about chemistry. Physics, the physics that I learned is gone, totally gone. Will women's studies be gone like physics is gone? Probably. But there'll be something else. We're always recategorizing. So long as we don't lose some of the things that I think are really elemental, mm-hmm. we're always going to have numbers, I hope. It's possible that we won't. There have been times when we didn't. But I think that there should be something that involves counting mm-hmm. and something that involves, that recognizes that the memory is a basic part of who we are, or it could be lost. Mm-hmm. And I think that I hope we will always have language. I don't care what language it is and how many there are, but the spoken word, the element of hearing, the response we have to cries out in the night, those kinds of things. Women's studies, sure. Goodbye. Mm-hmm. Won't matter.
Mm-hmm. So Missoula has kept you to a certain degree. I
mean, Missoula would keep
retired.
Anybody.
Well.
Missoula has a magnetism. You can put that down.
Are you still in touch or involved in the university at all?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I serve on the board of the Honors College. I served on the board of the Women's Studies. I don't think I do anymore. I think that board was just as off. But these are very peripheral things. You know, these are just kinds of make-believe things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the advisory committee, when we try to advise, nobody wants to listen, so.
What is the magnetism of Missoula? Is it related at all, for you anyway, to the university? I mean,
absolutely.
It is for me.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. I don't know what the University of Montana was like in the years that I was not here, but in the years that I was here, it was an, I suspect still is, an incredibly vibrant intellectual experience that welcomed young faculty members, because it hadn't been so, let me put it differently, the hierarchy that it has had was an intellectual rather than a political hierarchy. The heroes were great intellectual people rather than an outspoken president or what have you. Presidents were strong, but they were kind of boobs, and this was allowed, mm-hmm. so that it was a remarkably stimulating intellectual experience for young professors at that time, and I think still is.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of a better kind of life than to be a professor at an institution during the time that I was here because of the people who were here. I don't know if that mix is permanent. I don't know if it's always that way or would be. I was very, very lucky. I hope you are too. I hope that you find a university experience like I did.
Well, like I said, by following people, I tend to find exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really appreciate your
sure.
times and honoring your memory here. If there is anything else that you would like to finish this up with, please feel free to. Any memories or people that you haven't mentioned?
Probably.
Thoughts that you want to make sure get shared?
I have no thoughts that I want that I need to get shared, really. It's no, it's been fine.
Great. Well,
it's
I wish
fun.
I would have been around to take one of your classes.
You'd have had fun with me.
This is a nice second anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you.